From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what's the future for ethanol in our state as renewable energy sources become more and more crucial?
You know, that oil supply was built up over hundreds of millions of years, and we used it up in 100 years.
Plus, why is Michigan's school safety data so unbelievably wrong?
Yeah. There's a school with 600 students that, according to the state, had 4,815 cases of alcohol possession in 1 year.
And we look at the reason behind all those minus zero dashboard photos on Facebook.
That sense of kind of community is something that we don't anticipate coming out of social media, but can really spring from an event like this, where we are all kind of bearing through this shared experience.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been 13 years since the state of Michigan required our schools to report safety information. For instance, how many bullying incidents happened or how many students were caught with drugs or alcohol. But more than a decade later, it appears that requirement for information is a fail. On today's show, we dig into the extent of this problem and find out what it means for teachers, students, and parents. And then, if you've logged onto Facebook or perhaps Instagram in the past couple of days, certainly you've seen them. Photos of the massive amounts of snow piled up in our backyards or status updates complaining about what we all know, that it is really, really cold. So why do we all feel the need to share the same weather information on social media? We'll talk to an expert about that later in the hour. But first, 2014 is going to be a major year in Michigan politics. You can expect much of the spotlight to be fixed on the gubernatorial election with presumed candidates Rick Snyder for the GOP and Mark Schauer for the Dems. But Crane's Detroit Business thinks there are other names worth looking at in 2014. Writer Chris Gouts joins us now to talk about the people to watch in state politics. And the first name in your story, Chris, is someone who's been on Stateside recently talking about the dearth of women in Michigan government, and that would be Ingham County Clerk Barb Byram. Why is Barb on this list?
Well, I think for a couple of reasons. One is that it's not just my list that she's on. She also, in talking with a number of folks, she appears to be on Mark Schauer's list, on his short list for a lieutenant governor candidate. All the political folks say that he'd be wise to pick a woman to be on his ticket. And so she seems to be a candidate that a lot of people are talking about. She gained national attention, was it a year or so ago now during that abortion debate when she and Lisa Brown were silenced for a day the following day during a debate over abortion and received national attention for that. And from all accounts, she seems to be doing a really good job as the Ingham County Clerk, which also leads people to think that if she doesn't wind up on the Lieutenant Governor spot, that she might try to take on Ruth Johnson for Secretary of State.
Okay, and she did speak at length about what she sees as a problem with a lack of women in policymaking and legislative positions in Lansing. So it'll be interesting to see if she can move into that. Now, the next name on the list in your piece in Crane's Detroit Business is Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly. What does 2014 hold for him, do you think?
Well, I think quite a bit. Obviously, one of the big reasons why he's on the list is because he has this really unusual challenge for his spot on the ticket from at least one person right now, Wes Nakagiri, a Tea Party leader, I believe out of Heartland, who's running for the lieutenant governor seat, which is just a very odd thing. And so it's sort of forced this weird situation where Lieutenant Governor Kelly is going around the state talking to different GOP groups whose members are going to be those who cast their votes for the lieutenant governor position at the state party convention. Meanwhile, at the top of the ticket, his presumed running mate, Rick Snyder, hasn't actually announced that he's running yet. So, you know, you've got Kelly running, but the governor not officially. But then he's also going to be involved in a number of big issues still this year. He was very involved in the personal property tax reform that passed in late 2012. And right now, as the Michigan Municipal League and other groups try to fight to change that before there's this big August vote on whether or not to allow those changes to take place, he's really been at the forefront of leading those discussions about whether or not there'll be any changes prior to that vote.
You know, I'm betting that folks who do not closely follow politics in this state aren't aware that it's really the members of the at the GOP convention that will choose the governor's running mate and not the governor.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people did. I think there are some reporters, I think myself included, when I first heard about it, I was like, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right. But one thing that the Tea Party has done really well is that they understand, they've read the rules and they learn how to do it. And they really even tried the first time around. They tried to mount a challenge unsuccessfully. And this time that they've you know figured out how to go about it, and they're trying their best to unseat him.
And how much recognition, name-wise, do you think Wes Nakagiri has? Because I knew his name immediately. So is he doing the right things to get his name out there?
I think so. The problem is that we might know his name, but you know we're not going to be the voters at the state convention. So if as long as he's doing as much on the ground as lieutenant governor is, and going to these different county groups around the state and talking to those who are going to be the delegates, those are really going to be the people that are going to be getting phone calls nonstop. I would imagine leading up to the convention from lieutenant governor personally, and from Wes and from others who might get into the race. So. That's who he needs to make sure knows who he is.
If you just joined us, I'm speaking with Crane's Detroit business writer Chris Gouts, one of our regular stateside guests, and we're talking about his story in Crane's Detroit business, 10 people to watch in state politics. And another name on your watch list is someone who's been on stateside, and that's Equality Michigan Managing Director Emily Devendorf. Why is she on your list?
Well, I think for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, in the last couple of years, her group and she specifically have been working really hard, sometimes behind the scenes, sometimes not so much, working around the state, getting local municipalities to include protections for LGBT members of those communities to be included in their non-discrimination protections so that those in that community cannot be fired for being who they are mm-hmm. or for be discriminated in terms of housing. And they've been very successful so far. They've had 31 communities that represent about 20% of the state's population have included that ordinance, including cities like Detroit and Ann Arbor and Royal Oak most recently. But now she's really focused on a statewide bill. And so she's going to be really pushing that. And there have been some indications that, you know, something like that could happen. The governor has been very reticent to talk about it, as have some of the leaders. But my sense, and not so much talking to Emily, but in talking with others, is that I think there really is a really good chance that this could actually happen because in some ways it's good general election politics, not only for the governor, but for some other members. And so I think the hesitancy on the governor's part and some others to talk about their support for it right now is that if they talk about it too much, you know, some of them might be in danger of having a primary challenge. Or, you know, there could be some other, or it would give time for the opposition to really mount a strong, vehement defense on this. And so if the timing is right, it could happen, you know, pretty quickly. And then they could just get it done before, you know, the forces on the other side would decide not to. So I think that Emily's going to be at the forefront of that. And also, as part of this, you're going to see not only this, but she's going to be working to lay the groundwork for a 2016 repeal of the state's constitutional ban on gay marriage. And so I think as this progresses this year, I think 2015 will be really laying that groundwork. And then in 2016, hopefully the advocates think that they could actually repeal that that ban.
Moving over to the Michigan Democratic Party, you have Lon Johnson on your list of ones to watch in 2014. Why in particular, apart from the fact that he does head the Michigan Democratic Party?
Well, I think he has a lot on his plate, you mm-hmm. know, obviously, in his first year. I mean, he really did a lot of what people would say would be the impossible in unseating Mark Brewer. But, you know, that election aside, now he's got, you know, a handful of really major elections that he's going to be the one guiding. And so he's going to be trying to make sure that Mark Schauer can unseat Governor Snyder. He's going to try to keep the U.S. Senate seat that Carl Levin is retiring from, trying to keep that in the Democratic column. He wants to, you know, he's going to have to try to decide where to marshal his resources and in terms of trying to take back the state house, maybe pick up some seats in the Senate. There's three, I believe, state Supreme Court seats. So, and this is going to be all about resources and money, and we'll really see how he does at, you know, deciding where to spend those resources and where to, you know, really you know, putting what needs to happen. And so a lot of that's being done right now in terms of technology. They're really doing a lot in terms of identifying voters and using some of that micro-targeting and that micro-level data that President Obama used successfully in his presidential elections, and using some of that technology and some of that information here in Michigan to try to make sure that all Democrats come out and vote this fall.
And speaking of Democrats in the Senate in Lansing, you have Senator Rebecca Warren, Democratic senator from Ann Arbor, on your list.
Yeah, she's a really interesting person to be. I think I'd be on the list. One is that she's one of a few names that's being listed as those that would succeed term limited Gretchen Whitmer as the minority leader. And I say minority leader only because I think almost everyone, maybe except those who are trying to raise money for the Senate Democrats, would say that it's probably impossible that they're going to retake the majority, given that the Republicans right now have 26 seats
yes.
in the 38 member chamber. So, so I think we're safe to say that they'll be in the minority party again, and she seems to be the one that rises right now to that level to be the minority leader to take over. And she's also the Democratic caucus campaign chairwoman, so she's going to be going around the state meeting with those candidates who would eventually obviously elect the minority leader. So she's going to be doing a lot of work there. But she's also been involved in a lot of issues and has actually had some success. There was a breastfeeding bill that she had been really working on that passed right before the end of session last month, and so she's been really working on that, and also some things regarding autism. She's got another bill out there that she's been really pushing, and she's been involved in quite a few issues. Even though she's, by all accounts, the most liberal member of the Senate, she actually has a fairly decent track record of working across the aisle and actually getting things done.
Interesting. Lots of folks to keep our eye on, and there's even more. The article is 10 People to Watch in State Politics, and you can read it in the January 5th issue of Crain's Detroit Business. Chris Gouts, as always, thanks for being on Stateside.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you've logged into Facebook or checked your Instagram or Twitter accounts, or really over the last 48 hours, no doubt you have seen the photos, pictures of smartphone screens showing negative digit temperatures, or a photo of the friend with the measuring stick in the snow, or the always present patio furniture with 17 inches of snow on it. Or maybe you've read what all appear to be the same status updates, telling us all pretty much what we know. It is really cold out there. So just what's behind this need to share, or some may say overshare, through social media what we're all experiencing? Cliff Lampe is an assistant professor at the School of Information at the University of Michigan. So, Cliff, this is your job. You study why and how we all use social media. What is it about this weather in particular that has so many of us feeling the need to compare weather notes?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So there are some great social science studies about this. One thing to keep in mind is that everybody on social media has an audience that they're interacting with, and that audience has a mixture of both close friends and distant friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we post something like a picture of your deck furniture or the snapshot of your iPhone with how cold it is, you're fulfilling multiple kind of goals. One is something we call social proof in social science. This is an idea that my colleague Nicole Ellison gave me this morning. And it's basically the idea that, you know, you want to show proof of what's going on. So even though it's a banal thing, like a picture of the food that you're eating or your kid doing something cute or how snowy it is, you're basically showing a picture as a proof of something that goes beyond just a status update that would say it's cold outside, right?
Okay.
And that social proof is, I think, more vernacularly known as pics or it didn't happen. right? Yeah. So this is the way that a lot of practitioners talk about this in terms of having, you know, some sort of proof about what's going on and having the ability to say, this is the reality at the moment.
So it's almost as if it's not real unless it's up on my Facebook wall in a picture?
In a picture, it really helps, right? So and it has a more emotional resonance to show a picture of it than it does just to say it's really cold outside. And for some reason, that's just something we do with a whole wide range of things that go on in our lives.
Now, I can only assume that you've been following all of these weather posts online Sure. The last couple of days. What are you seeing? Anything surprise you? Anything particularly funny or creative?
You know, there's a lot of memes that are being generated right now. So a lot of, I really enjoy the satellite pictures of Michigan during this snowstorm. I enjoy kind of how people are dealing with the snow in fun ways. So you see a lot of people who are doing things like blowing bubbles to see the bubbles freeze as they're being blown, or who throw the boiling water, which you should be careful about, and see it turn immediately into snow, or making ice cream out of Michigan snow. So I've been really amazed at how people turn this type of weather event into a fun thing. And I think it being an event is an important thing, right? We tend to share what's unusual for us. And for all of us, even though it's a common experience, it's still an unusual experience personally for it to be this cold. And it's also a common experience that allows us to share that unusual experience with everybody else.
All right. So what did we do before we had Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and social media? Were we sitting around the campfire at the end of the day after the hunt talking it over? Or was the town crier the one that we would turn to? How did we do that?
Probably the modern version of the campfire, which is the water cooler. So this would be something you would talk about with your colleagues when you got into work, or you would talk about at school. You know, sure is cold out there would be something you might talk about, or you know, share a picture that you took on your old school camera back in the day. But really, it's moved into social media in a way that's different even than previous forms of media, because now we do have that broader audience. So, you know, you can have friends in California who, it's not just that you're sharing this experience with your Michigan friends, but you are showing your friends in other parts of the world, no, it really does get pretty cold here, friends, you know, and that's another way that social media is slightly different than older forms of media. But of course, we've always talked about these types of shared experiences quite often in the past, mostly in face-to-face groups, though.
But it's much more immediate. It lets you snap that picture and get it up there so your nephew in Ireland can see the fact that, you know, it's minus 14 here.
Yes, and that's Fahrenheit. So.
Yes, that's right. Is this a good thing, do you think? Is this a positive development in communication, or are we in our own little bubbles playing to our own imaginary audiences?
Well, as a professor, I can never say anything's unqualifiedly good or bad, so I would say it's mixed. But I do think it's in generally a good thing, because what you see is that people are sharing their shared experiences, right? And one of the other goals that people have when they share something like how cold it is that they can say, they get a little emotional support from their friends, right? They can say, like, I'm suffering this too, or my car got stuck, or it was trouble getting my snow removed. And so that sense of kind of community is something that we don't anticipate coming out of social media, but can really spring from an event like this, where we are all kind of bearing through this shared experience.
So when somebody can put on their status, hooray, they finally shoveled out my street, that's just kind of, yeah, we're all in this together.
Right. Or you know, what do I do with my pets when it's so cold? Or, you know, hey, it's frosting up inside my windows right now. That's mm-hmm. Those are all things that, you know, if I can see other people are going through that, it normalizes the experience for me too.
Fascinating stuff, and I think we can all agree we can lay off the patio furniture pictures. Try something more unique. Cliff Lampe, assistant professor at the School of Information at the University of Michigan. Cliff, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've heard many ideas and proposals floated about for ways to rebuild Detroit, to help it back from the depths of bankruptcy. But there has been one group, it could be argued, that's been overlooked in these conversations, the LGBTQ community. And that is quite an oversight, considering that, as my next guest writes in Slate, gays and lesbians are known to be drivers of gentrification. And as the CEO and president of the Detroit Economic Growth Corporation says about Detroit, bring on more gentrification. Joining me is Ross Benish, journalist and researcher. His piece for Slate is entitled, The Latest Plan to Save Detroit, Build a Gay Neighborhood. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, Cindy.
And we're joined by Curtis Lipscomb, who's executive director of KIC. It's a center for LGBTQ African Americans in Detroit. Curtis, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Cindy, for having me.
Good to have you both. Ross, I want to ask you about your piece in Slate. Tell us how you think building a gay neighborhood in Detroit could help save the city.
Well, I'd say the word save is a little bit overstating. I know that was in the headline, but I don't want to come off as if building a neighborhood is just going to fix all the problems. But I do think it would be a good step in the right direction, mostly because of what's happened in other cities where LGBT folks are drivers of gentrification. It's happened in Chicago, notably in Boys Town, Washington, D.C., and DuPont Circle, also in Shaw, Logan Circle, in New Orleans, New York City, San Francisco. And the thing is that when you have a city that has poor public school systems, high crime, but also offers authenticity and artistic things, it lends itself to attracting LGBT folks. And a lot of that has to do with a less likelihood of having children. So Detroit, I would say, wants to bring in any citizens it can who are going to have jobs, who are going to pay taxes to help increase the city's revenue. And the LGBT community is an opportunity because, as Gary Gates from UCLA notes, LGBT couples, are about 20% of them right now are raising children. And if you look at straight couples, it's over 40%. So a straight adult couple is going to be more than twice as likely to be sensitive to school district. And when if you have kids, you're going to be more sensitive to crime. You're going to have less of your income that's disposable because you're saving it.
Okay.
So really, it's a demographic that the city has a chance to bring in that can it's not going to be, waves and waves of people. And also, as Richard Florida notes, if you have a prominent gay community, that also signals tolerance. And that'll bring in other creative types and, like artists and bohemians that will also help redevelop areas.
Indeed. Ross, I like your quote from urbanist Richard Florida, who argues that cities that lack gays and rock bands are losing the economic development race. And it's a real interesting thought. And Curtis Lipscomb, tell us, is there now a core area of gay life in Detroit?
Yes. There is a core area of gays in Detroit, but those gays you will see during the business hours of 5 p.m. to 2 in the morning. Culturally, our identifiable gay neighborhood has been Palmer Park.
Yes.
Palmer Park is located a couple of miles north from the city border, and it has been our neighborhood since World War II. There was a nightclub, most notably the nightclub Minjo's, that we know that Madonna was discovered at.
Mm-hmm.
Restaurants like Backstreet.
Backstage and, Deli, Backstage, I miss
yes,
it.
Thank you. The Backstage Restaurant and other businesses along that area of 6 Mile and Woodward. But over a period of time, that population migrated to the suburbs, the northern suburbs at that.
Specifically Ferndale, right? Ferndale drew quite a few folks.
Well, Ferndale were the people that where the movement ended up at.
Mm.
The original migration was to Royal Oak. Royal Oak wasn't as welcoming as other northern suburbs, and so it was Ferndale that they looked at and reimagined and took the opportunity to make it that identifiable district.
And Ferndale, I will say this because I grew up in Ferndale, and I've watched Ferndale that really kind of hit a dry patch and has really come back, is a vibrant downtown. That stretch of 9 Mile has lots going on. It elected a gay mayor in Craig Covey. So I think you're kind of pointing to that as an example of what kind of activity could benefit Detroit.
Right. And so what also happened was that still you had this migration of gays that moved to the Oakland County, but you still had a significant amount of gays still in Detroit. And those in Detroit were predominantly African-American. And so those that remained in the city stayed in Palmer Park. And so as we see Detroit move, there's this new conversation of where do we want this new community to occur. Now, there's always been a community, so let's be very clear.
Right.
I grew up in Detroit. I was raised in gay culture as a teenage boy. There was always culture here, as we know. It is a city that protects us. But we would like to reimagine Detroit in this new kind of identity, this new type of LGBT community. And KIC is going to lead that, as we've been in Midtown since 2007. And our location has been a place where gays and lesbians have always flocked for educational opportunities, programming opportunities, and special event plannings.
So there has been that core there. And I would suspect that the piece that Ross Banish wrote in Slate, kind of looking at all of the ways that this can help Detroit, will help. And Ross, you point out something that perhaps not everyone was sensitive to, and that was the fact that while Kwame Kilpatrick was mayor, he repeatedly disparaged the gay community.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's comments that I moved to Detroit about 6 months ago, and that was something that people that I talked to for this mm-hmm. story, you know, often came back to me with, that they didn't feel welcomed by, like, the city government, essentially, and that Kwame, you know, repeatedly made comments about, like, you know, not wanting his children to see that kind of lifestyle.
Now, when Mike Dungan gave his acceptance speech for mayor, he gave a little shout out to the LGBT community. Let's listen to what he had to say.
We all share the same dreams. And as you know, and I've said 100 times, it does not matter if you are black, brown, or white. It does not matter if you are Christian, Jewish, or Muslim. It does not matter if you are gay or straight. It does not matter if you were born in the city of Detroit or you're an immigrant from another country. All of us are sharing a dream to rebuild this city together.
And what were your thoughts, Curtis, when you heard Mike Dungan make those statements?
I think that was a great statement to make, but there are statements and then there are realities. And in the state of Michigan, we are not safe. And so we're working to amend our state civil rights law so that gays and lesbians are protected in the workspace. When Kwame Kilpatrick made some not so pleasant remarks, many of us was unhappy with that. But as I said in the article, and as I said to other people, it is not the politicians that's going to move our community. It's going to be the people. And we've been in business while Kwame was in office, and we will remain in business while Mayor-elect Dugan be in office. And so it is the people that are going to make sure that this is a thriving community. Though we want the Mayor-elect's support and other elected officials' support, as we've had from City Council members Tate, Jones, Santil, and others, had for years. It is the people that are going to make this community vibrant.
Ross, as you researched your piece that you wrote for Slate, did you get a sense that there are specific areas, neighborhoods in Detroit that could become? I know, Curtis, you said you're based in Midtown. Where could Detroit's gay neighborhood take root and thrive?
As far as an area to look at, Curtis mentioned Palmer Park earlier. And that seems like that would be a very logical choice. And the reason I say that is because in Liverpool, England, there actually is a project going on right now that is somewhat similar to what Curtis is doing, in that there's some urban developers that are redeveloping a gay district there. You know, it's not happening organically like gay enclaves usually do. And the spot that they're doing this in is Stanley Street, and that's where the gay district historically has been in Liverpool. And a lot of the reason they're doing that is not just because infrastructure is ready there, but because there's that history and that authenticity. Earlier I mentioned that Detroit could be attractive to creative folks because it has that, you know, authenticity. Detroit isn't a place that's filled with strip malls and Chili's and a bunch of franchises. You know, it's locally owned things. It's people that have been there for a long time, people that have been through a lot of stuff, really. And in Palmer Park, since you already have that history there, I think you could build upon that.
Ross is right. We've created a survey earlier this year asking about 1,000 people, what areas would you like to see the LGBT community to be developed at? And of the top three was downtown, Midtown, and Palmer Park. So we know that Palmer Park is culturally our gay neighborhood. And so what KIC did was create a visibility campaign called LGBT and the D, where we obtained a billboard right at 6 Mile and Woodward that shows what LGBT looks like. Many faces of trans people, young people, old people, particularly African-American. And so when you take Woodward home or to work, we know by the end of December about 25,000 views will be held at that billboard. So we're making a statement. We're saying that this could be our revitalized neighborhood. We already know we have a great nonprofit there called Friends of Palmer Park doing redevelopment in the park. We have building owners revitalizing those Abercon buildings. Our project, Hotter Than July, which we hold every year, which is our big gay pride, we've been holding at Palmer Park since 1996. So it only makes sense that once we leave Midtown, we may proceed to Palmer Park. We're doing research to see if that's viable, and you'll see the fruit of our labor by 2016.
We will be watching. We've been speaking with Curtis Lipscomb, who's the executive director of KIC, the Center for LGBTQ African Americans in Detroit, joined by Ross Benish, journalist and researcher. His recent piece for Slate is entitled "The Latest Plan to Save Detroit, Build a Gay Neighborhood." Thanks so much to both of you for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Parents want to know, how safe is my kid's school? How many incidents of bullying have happened, for example? How many kids caught with drugs or alcohol? Well, it's been more than a decade since the state of Michigan required the reporting of school safety information. But it appears that requirement is failing. Bridge Magazine writer Ron French recently dug into the extent of this problem. Hello, Ron.
Hello, Cynthia. Good to be here.
Good to have you back. I'm betting most parents don't know what they don't know.
I'm afraid you're right on that, Cynthia. It's pretty interesting. We've been collecting as a state this data for 13 years, and for 13 years the data has been completely filled with inaccuracies. Just some crazy things.
So give us an example. I know you lead your story in Bridge Magazine off with Caro High School.
Yeah. There's a school with 600 students that, according to the state, had 4,815 cases of alcohol possession in 1 year. That's 8 cases of kids carrying beer in the hallways per year.
Wow.
And Heartland High School, there, close to here in Livingston County, they supposedly had 12 suicide attempts in 1 year, and they actually had zero. There was a Brethren High School, which is a small school near Manistee. They supposedly had 190 cases of bullying, and that is in a school with only 164 students.
Wow. In fact, you quote the superintendent of that school saying, "We could have had Richie Incognito here as a motivational speaker, and we couldn't have had that much bullying."
That's right. Yeah. Needless to say, all these numbers are inaccurate. And they seem almost funny, you know, when you hear the numbers. But when you get down to it, what this points out is something serious, and that is that how safe children feel in school affects their ability to learn. And we as parents have no ability at this point to know how safe our schools are.
Well, what's causing this? Just, you know, these gross errors in statistics.
Well, everyone's pointing fingers at each other, Cynthia. But what it comes down to is reporting error. This is one of hundreds of reports that are filled out by schools. Most of these reports are filled out not even at the superintendent level, but at the principal or lower level. And as one principal told me, you know, we have more reports to fill out than we have days of school in the year.
Wow.
So that some things just and so you prioritize, and sometimes things either don't get done or they get done very quickly and errors are made. The state feels strongly that it's a reporting error at the part of the schools. That could be true. It could not be true. But the point is that there is no incentive for the schools to report, to take a lot of time to report this correctly. And it causes problems then for families.
Well, and as you pointed out, Ron French, that children will learn better when they feel secure. But it seems that the data is way wrong, that, you know, there aren't these, 4,815 cases of alcohol possession at Caro High School. So is there really a problem, in a sense? If that's not the case, and kids are going to go to Caro High School if you live in Caro, you know, regardless of inaccurate report data. So do parents really, are they going to get something out of these statistics?
They get nothing out of statistics now, and that's why the state has pulled them from public view. After 13 years, they finally said, you know, maybe we have to pull this away and actually figure out how to correct it. But you're right. The data as it exists now is useless. Parents don't look at it, okay? But the point is, should we look at it? Mm. Is this something that it's important for us to know?
Maybe I'm reading between the lines, but it sounds like there needs to be money spent somehow, perhaps state money given to these local districts for the time and manpower hours to put these reports together?
It could be a matter of money. It could just be a matter of emphasizing the importance of this. This is a report that no one has taken seriously, at the state level or at the school level. You know, it's important for the state to know this data, because that way we can see what sort of trends we are having. If there's an increase or decrease in bullying, for example, if there's an increase or decrease in truancy, which is reported on this. For goodness sake, suicide attempts, we should know about that. It's not about the errors we see here. It's about the fact we do not know. But I think that it's something, especially today, when parents have so many more school choices and they're out there shopping, that families know how safe their schools are, and it's tough to do right now.
So what do we take away from your report? Is this an issue that needs to be addressed more at the local school level or at a policy level in Lansing?
It's something that needs to be addressed at the Michigan Department of Education. They are currently trying to figure out what they can do to encourage schools to report this more accurately and more timely, and then how to check for errors in a more appropriate way. This is something I think that may be fixed within the next year, because there's been a bit of an outcry about this now.
Ron French, writer for Bridge Magazine. Ron, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been 7 years now since America hit the accelerator on corn-based ethanol fuels. Homegrown corn became the centerpiece of a push to find an alternative to foreign oil. President Bush signed the expansion of the Renewable Fuel Standard, RFS, in 2007, promising it would make us stronger, cleaner, and more secure. But as is so often the case, something that offers great promise on one hand takes its toll on the other hand. So the view of corn-based ethanol very much depends upon which side of the fence you're standing on. Proponents, including the Michigan Corn Growers Association, say corn-based ethanol is a greener source of fuel, the future of our energy. And many farmers in Michigan and across the Corn Belt rushed to convert pasture and conservation land for corn, grateful for the chance to earn a better living thanks to this new market for their crop. But critics worry about environmental damage, destroyed habitat, increased fertilizer use threatening water supplies, and global warming as that converted land is plowed and releases carbon dioxide that had been locked into the soil. Well, now we hear the Obama administration has proposed reducing the amount of ethanol that must be blended into our gasoline supply. Farmers are protesting. Ethanol advocates worry it's a step backward for alternative energy. And they're accusing Big Oil and its lobbyists of slinging misinformation and myths about corn-based ethanol. Let's take a closer look at the future of ethanol and what our renewable energy future might look like. Joining us now is Bruce Dale, a professor of chemical engineering and former chair of the Department of Chemical Engineering and Materials Science at Michigan State University. And his MSU bio notes, and let me quote here, in plain terms, Professor Dale is trying to figure out what we will do to provide environmentally sustainable fuels and chemical products for our society once the age of petroleum winds to its inevitable end sometime in this century. Professor, you say you hope this age of petroleum ends with a whimper and not a bang. What do you mean by that?
Well, of course, it's an allusion to poetry there, but the idea is the whimper is that it'll go out quietly instead of with a bang, which it could happen. In other words, resource wars or just generally environmental and social disruption, because we've been so reliant on petroleum for so long.
And I think disruption probably is a modest look at what might happen just based on what we've seen when gasoline prices rocket upwards. Imagine, it's impossible to imagine having this age end.
Well, we've known nothing else, but we better accustom ourselves to something else, because conventional or cheap oil supply has clearly peaked. And now any additional oil that we get is going to be from very dirty sources like the tar sands or dangerous sources like ultra-deep water. We're in a pickle.
Can you help us with this differing of views over corn-based ethanol? Because, you know, we hear it has made life better for America's corn farmers. It gives us an alternative to petroleum and foreign petroleum. And then we hear about environmental damage and questions whether ethanol is harmful to engines and we're converting food into fuel. Where do you believe the truth lies about corn-based ethanol?
We have to separate two issues here. One is the corn itself, and the other is the ethanol as a fuel. I don't think there's any doubt at all but what corn-based ethanol has been good for America's farmers. It's increased their markets, increased the price of corn. It's reduced the amount of government subsidies that you and I are paying to that we've always paid or paid in the past to keep corn low priced. On the other hand, corn production has some environmental drawbacks. It simply does. And I think that what we see with the change in the RFS is corn-based ethanol has kind of reached the limits of its political support. Now, ethanol as a fuel is another issue. Ethanol is a very fine fuel, and if we're smart about how we use ethanol, if we were smart about it, we'd be probably blending ethanol in blends around 30% with gasoline, where the mileage penalty disappears and you get the value of ethanol's high octane, and it's a much cleaner way of providing octane, less harmful than we're currently doing with aromatics like benzene, a known carcinogen.
So I know with your research you have proven that you don't need to make ethanol with only corn. Can you talk about some of the alternative sources?
Sure. A lot of the attention in the RFS, of course, has been focused around corn-based ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
But the United States actually committed itself by that law to produce even larger volumes over a longer period of time, larger volumes of ethanol from cellulosic materials. These are grasses, straws, wood chips, parts of municipal solid waste. They're not part of the food supply, but they're also quite a bit more difficult and therefore currently more expensive to produce. And so the idea was to establish a market for them that would help drive the industry to scale so that the prices could come down, the technology could get established. And if we develop those fuels, those cellulosic fuels correctly, then we can have very large volumes of fuel and also environmental improvements. Again, done right, done well,
yeah,
you'd get very large environmental improvements.
Is the reason this has not caught on, this cellulosic source, because of the oil lobby or the farm lobby or both?
It's a complicated story, so I'll just try to give you the outlines. We hit what we call the blend wall. This isn't a technical limit, but it's a policy limit of how much ethanol we'd allow to be blended in our gasoline supply at about 10% by volume. We already produce enough corn-based ethanol to hit that target, so there really was literally no room for ethanol from cellulosic ethanol. And then with the reduction in the amount of corn ethanol in the RFS2, the situation's gotten even murkier. But ethanol by itself is a very fine fuel, and we should be making, I think, intelligent use of its fuel properties in our engines.
Is there the political interest? Are there policymakers in Washington who are on board with this push towards cellulosic ethanol?
Yes. I think that there's still very strong support. And, in fact, I have a number of friends in the environmental community. They have very strong support for ethanol made or any other biofuel, but ethanol is the one that we know how to make in the shorter term. I'm talking by next 5 to 10 years. Ethanol is a fuel we know how to make, and there's a lot of support for it made from these grasses and straws and wood chips and so forth. What there is not support for, though, and I think, again, we saw this, is to further expand the amount of corn-based ethanol. I know that's a bitter pill for my friends in the corn ethanol industry to take, but I think this shows pretty clearly that we've reached kind of the high water mark of what's going to be publicly supportable in terms of corn ethanol.
I'm speaking with Bruce Dale, who's a professor of chemical engineering at Michigan State University, and you work with the University of Wisconsin, and MSU has teamed together to form the Great Lakes Bioenergy Center. So what are some of the promising directions that research is going at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Center?
Well, to back up just a moment, this center was started its operation about 6 years ago, and it's receiving approximately $135 million over 10 years to develop sustainable cellulosic biofuels, ethanol one of them, but we have others on our plate. I direct or help lead one of the research areas there, but the whole effort of the Great Lakes Bioenergy is to try to develop sustainable cellulosic biofuels. And so we have combined efforts on environmental research, on deconstruction, that's breaking plant material down into sugars, on fermentation and on basic plant science to try to improve the processing properties and the sustainability of the plant material.
When I think about what you're saying with cellulosic ethanol, and you say there's even some other possible things on kind of in the pipeline, It is certainly clear that as a society, we've always had to pay a cost for any source of fuel, whether we're shoveling horse droppings or carbon emissions and global warming. And then we see Fukushima and Chernobyl and now the environmental concerns about the corn-based ethanol. So do you think cellulosic ethanol could give us the most energy at the lowest cost?
I don't think we will ever have anything, again, to approach $20 or $10 a barrel oil in terms of lowest cost. That was, you know, that oil supply was built up over hundreds of millions of years, and we used it up in 100 years. Okay,
wow.
So no, that won't happen. Can we get enough sustainable produce to live decently? I think so. I think we can, but it won't be the energy extravaganza that we've enjoyed over the last 100 years. I just don't see any combination of energy sources that's going to allow us to do that, what we had with oil.
What are your thoughts, and when you think about your mission and what you do, Bruce, how do you want to help make sure that this country is still beautiful and it's still productive and that there is energy and fuel for our grandchildren?
Well, my own personal efforts, and are largely funded by Great Lakes Bioenergy, but also other support that we've received, notably from the folks at GM, we're trying to figure out how to design sustainable bioenergy systems. We know what we need to do, but now we need to, as an engineer here, where you think about a whole system and you try to imagine the properties that you want it to have and then what kind of targets for performance. And we're working right now to try to establish what a sustainable cellulosic biofuel system would look like. How would it treat land? How would it treat water? How would it treat air? How would it treat biodiversity? And establish targets, design targets to do that. So that's enough to keep me busy for another 20 years.
And as you say, it feels, I can tell from what you say, it feels as though the clock is ticking on the petroleum party we've been having.
Production of conventional cheap oil peaked in 2005, and any increase that we've had in quote-unquote oil since then has been from places like the tar sands or like our own drilling at tight shale formations. Those are much more expensive economically, and they have the potential to be a lot more environmentally destructive. So yeah, the clock is ticking on us.
Bruce Dale, professor of chemical engineering at Michigan State University and also with the Great Lakes Bioenergy Center. Thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside, Bruce.
It's been my pleasure.
We always want to hear from you. What stories are you focusing on in the new year? What issues do you want to hear more about or people? Let us know. Find us on Facebook. You can search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And you can find us on the website, michiganradio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside. And while you're there, you can find stories and conversations you just might have missed. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Stay warm, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.